I'm here with Amelia Gentleman, who is the Guardian journalist who broke the Windrush scandal story. Amelia, thank you so much for agreeing to this interview today.
Thank you for asking me.
I really, really enjoyed reading your book and learning about your investigative journalism, basically the work that went into bringing this the Windrush scandal to light. I just wondered if we could start by learning a little bit more about you as a journalist, as a person, and just maybe if you could tell me perhaps how you got into journalism and how you became interested in investigating and learning about this particular case.
So I've been a journalist since I graduated, more or less, from university. I think I'm quite unusual in that I always knew that that's what I really wanted to do. And so I did, I was kind of school newspaper editor, and I did a bit of journalism as a student. And I was quite clear that that's what I wanted to do afterwards. And I started working as a trainee with the Press Association, which is a news agency based in London. And then quite quickly, I moved to The Guardian, where I've stayed more or less ever since. I did leave for a while and worked for the New York Times and the Herald Tribune in India. But most of the time since I graduated, I've been working for The Guardian. So I think it's coming up for 20 years in two batches. And I think that's kind of relevant to the work that I did on Windrush, because I was already quite a kind of experienced journalist when this fell onto my desk. And I think that really helped, because it is an incredibly complicated issue. It's not an issue that I was at all an expert in. I was new to all of the history of immigration to the UK. But I think, I think it helped that I'd been working for quite a bit of time. Most of the time since, the first bit of my career I spent working abroad. I studied Russian and history at university, and I was really keen to work in Moscow, and I spent a couple of years working there when Putin came to power, and then I spent a couple of years working in France for The Guardian, a couple of years as a deputy foreign editor when 9/11 happened. And then some time in India. So I've worked around the place quite a bit.
And where did your interest in kind of immigration policy, and particularly looking at the impact of policy, government policy on people, where did that start?
So when I came back to the UK after being based in India, I didn't really have a very clear job. In fact, I didn't have a job at all to go to at The Guardian, and I had quite a difficult couple of years trying to get a job back. And during that period, I was not exactly freelance, but on a words contract, which meant that I only got paid for the words that I wrote. And in retrospect, it was quite a good thing, I think, because it meant that I didn't have anybody really telling me what to do. I had to come up with interesting things to write about and persuade editors that they should let me write about them. And one of the things I really was interested in doing was writing about government policy of all sorts, but looking at the way that it played out on individuals it was kind of designed for, to see whether or not it was working in the way that it was meant to work. Mm-hmm. So I didn't do much political reporting in Westminster. It was much more trying to get out of London and talk to people. And a lot of time I spent looking at welfare reform and changes to the benefits system, particularly around disability benefits, which were a huge part of the reforms that the coalition government brought in after 2010. And then I began to look a bit more at immigration when we saw the crisis in Calais around 2016, well, when we saw the huge kind of migration across Europe. But I was particularly interested in talking to people who were stuck in Calais at that time, when the numbers were soaring to around 10 or 12,000 people.
And at that time, was the hostile environment, was that on your radar in terms of the work you were doing? Were people aware of it when you were...
So I wasn't aware of it at all, and in retrospect I find that really amazing. But the hostile environment policies were bits of legislation that were introduced in 2014 and 2016 in two separate bits of legislation. I got that right. I think those are the dates.
I think it was 2012.
Oh, is it 2012 and 2014? Yes. And I think one of the really positive things that reporting on the Windrush scandal did, although it was a bit belated, was really educating people in what these bits of legislation were and the really clearly stated hostile intent behind them. Because I think that for everybody, and certainly I wasn't as aware of what the implications of these policies were until much later, when I was trying to understand why people were being badly affected by the Home Office.
So were you already hearing stories about people being unable then to access their benefits or being mistreated then by the welfare system? Were you linking that to immigration issues at the time?
So, not really. I mean, I suppose the kind of relevant link for me was the way that I was trying to do the reporting, which was when, particularly with around reforms to disability benefit, when a lot of people who were very vulnerable and unable to work were tested for their capacity to work by this newly computerised work capability assessment. And we saw a lot of people being classified as fit to work who really were not at all fit to work. And the way that we covered that in The Guardian was by highlighting individual case after individual case after individual case to try and help readers and also policymakers understand the real impact of what had been happening. And that was quite a useful prototype for the reporting that I did later around Windrush. Although I wouldn't say that the impact of reporting on the welfare reforms had a huge success in terms of shifting government policy, but it did at least make people very aware of what was happening.
Okay, so you said to me that the story fell onto your desk. What do you mean by that? How did you come to? I know you go into some detail in your book, but how did that really start?
Like all journalists, I come into the office every morning. I've usually got, you know, four or five different things that I'm working on. But I'm also reading all of the emails that come in. And because I've done quite a bit of travelling around the country, talking to different charities and individuals around the place, I'm often contacted by people who I've spoken to before who flag up something that they think is, you know, something that The Guardian might be interested in. And the flag for this issue was an email from the Refugee and Migrant Centre in Wolverhampton, which was a charity I'd visited a couple of years earlier, and they wanted to raise they wanted to bring the Guardian's attention to the case of Paulette Wilson, who was at that point being held in Yarlswood Immigration Detention Centre, which is an immigration detention centre that's quite well known or notorious for its very difficult conditions. And it's a place I had written about previously. So I knew that being held at Yarlswood was, you know, not great, but particularly arresting, I suppose, about the email was the information that this was somebody who'd been in the UK for 49 or 50 years and had arrived here as an 8 or 9 year old child entirely legally to live with her grandparents near outside Birmingham somewhere.
And when you say entirely legally, what do you mean by that?
Well, maybe I'm putting that parenthesis in retrospectively, but the charity made it clear at that point that this was somebody who they believed had not broken any immigration rules and was somebody who had been living here for 50 years and had the right to live here. So it just seemed extremely peculiar that she had been arrested, was being held in this notorious immigration detention centre, and that she was booked to be removed to Jamaica, which was a country that she hadn't visited since 1968. So when I say it fell on my plate, it sort of did, because that is such an unusual and disturbing story that I think that any reporter who was emailed about it would respond to say that's really disturbing and it's worthy of some attention.
And in your book, then, you refer to this group as a group of retirement age, Commonwealth-born, long-term UK residents with immigration problems, which I think is a really helpful way of actually detailing the people who are affected by the scandal itself, because it highlights that the scandal affected people far beyond the Caribbean. It also highlights that it has created problems for people who basically have worked their entire lives in the UK and have spent the bulk of their life here. But again, the term that you come up with in what you talk about, the Windrush betrayal or the Windrush scandal, how did that come to be?
So that encapsulation of what the problem was about is an accurate one. But it was also quite a problematic one from a journalistic perspective, because it was complicated. And it was the case that the vast majority of people who were being flagged as affected by this issue were at that point people who'd come from the Caribbean. And a campaigner called Patrick Vernon, who has long been a campaigner for the Windrush generation and for has been advocating on their behalf and trying to get the government to recognise what an extraordinary contribution that they've made to this country. He identified from reading the articles in The Guardian that the people who were being affected were a group of people who you could, as a kind of shorthand, refer to as the Windrush generation. And in a way, it was a very helpful way of getting a wider audience to engage with a story that was otherwise really, really complicated.
And it was also around the 70th anniversary.
It was coming up to the 70th anniversary. Yeah, and as a shorthand, it's a really potent one, because it immediately helps people to understand who we're talking about, who's been affected by these immigration issues. much later, I question how helpful it's been, because it's confusing for a lot of people, because it does narrow the scope of the scandal to a fairly small geographical area, and it makes people get confused because they think, well, is this about people who actually arrived on the ship in 1948, or, you know, does this issue affect people who come from Nigeria or Ghana or Pakistan, which it can do.
So why would this? So you tell in the book the stories of many people, Paul Eccleston, who you just mentioned, Anthony Bryan, I think, Hubert Howard, and a number of others. Was that your decision then, to focus on the stories you were getting from people who were born to Caribbean parents, or was it just the way that the story unfolded as you began to kind of dig deeper?
I didn't hear from people who came from other countries until much later.
Why do you think that was?
Well, there are lots of competing factors, I think, about migration patterns. And I still feel that I'm not totally expert in it, but I think many of the people who came from the Caribbean came at a time when they had no need to think about immigration or borders when they arrived in the UK. And so this absolutely wasn't on their radar. And many of them also didn't make regular return journeys to their home country, either because the salaries that they were earning here didn't allow it, or because enough of their families had moved with them that they didn't need to. Whereas in other countries, there might already have been enough of a sense of immigrating into the UK that getting paperwork immediately felt like a real, like a really, really important thing, in a way that it didn't for people coming from the Caribbean.
And I think that's a really important point, because so people came as citizens of the UK and the Commonwealth, but yeah, also throughout the Caribbean, from Jamaica, Barbados, Trinidad, St. Kitts, all over, they were told they were British. So I think there's definitely, I think the Windrush scandal, and understanding it from a Caribbean and a transnational perspective is hugely important, because I think, as you say very, very clearly in your book again, that, you know, when at that time there was really no difference travelling from Kingston to London, from London to Glasgow. The idea was you were part of the empire and you were travelling from one part of the empire to the other. So
yeah, that's right. That's right. But it's definitely the case that as this kind of reporting unfolded, these were distinctions that weren't immediately clear. And in retrospect, I know which immigration historians I would like to have consulted at an earlier stage, because it was really, really mysterious for a number of months why it was that with such regularity people from one part of the world were coming forward and saying that they were experiencing these difficulties.
And also because a lot of people affected were children who came on their parents' passports. So they were passports that were either lost or as you said, people hadn't left the country, so they physically didn't have anything to show or to prove, as the British state was telling them, to prove that they did have the legitimate right to remain. So how did you start tying those threads together? Did you have a terrible question, I know, but did you have like a eureka moment? Was there something that you have in your memory that sparked something that helped you begin to see this as a bigger story?
So even Even when I spoke to Paulette Wilson in her flat in Wolverhampton, because by the time I got to see her, her MP had intervened and her removal had been postponed. So I was able to see her at home, although at a time when she was still waiting for the removal order to be reenacted. Even at that point, the caseworker at the Refugee and Migrant Centre said that he was familiar with other cases of people who were getting frightening letters from the Home Office telling them that they didn't have the right to be here, or people who were finding that it was very, very difficult to apply for their pension or to remain in their house, people who were having kind of unexplained bureaucratic problems. So he wasn't fully clear about what was causing it, but he did make it obvious that this was a wider problem than just one woman who'd been treated very badly. And then when we published that piece, new people came forward almost immediately. And the second person who I interviewed, he's a man called Anthony Bryan, about whom there's this really, really good film called Sitting in Limbo that the BBC made. He told me that he knew four or five other people who were having similar difficulties. Four or five other people who'd also arrived in the 1960s.
Who he'd been at school with as well.
Yeah. And indeed, his one of his brothers was also having real difficulties. So I'm not sure I'd describe it as a eureka moment, but that was very alarming to find out that this wasn't something that was restricted to a small group of people. If both of those people could kind of point to networks of other people also affected.
And certainly in the interviews that we've conducted so far, definitely the theme of fear comes through a lot. Mm. So either people either removing themselves entirely from the state, for example, for fear of being detected, or knowing that if they try to apply for a passport that could actually bring them future problems, which is definitely, I think, the case of the people that you reported on as well. So I just wondered how much bigger this issue is than we actually know about. I think the figures from the Oxford Migration Observatory were that there are about 57,000 people who are not formally naturalised in the country. But do you think that there's a huge component of people that have either continue their day-to-day that have either not been picked up by the system or are really, living under the radar, let's just say.
Yeah, I think it's still really hard to put a figure on the scale of the problem. And that is partly to do with fear. That question about of unease and reluctance to talk about their problems was something that was a real kind of battle from a reporting perspective, because a lot of people didn't want to go on the record to say that they'd had these Home Office problems because they felt ashamed. And they felt ashamed because the time at which I was doing this reporting was a time of kind of heightened anti-immigration rhetoric in the newspapers. But there was also a sense of alarm because a lot of the people affected felt wrongly that they were somehow responsible for the difficult situation that they found themselves in. And actually, it was quite interesting when this became a kind of national scandal that all newspapers were reporting on much later. There was some criticism from some quite kind of high-profile people of Caribbean origin who came forward and said, well, we sorted out our paperwork. You know, these people are just disorganised people. They should have got their acts together. And so there was that kind of sense of potential judgment, so that a lot of people didn't tell their own children
Yeah, and that's certainly the response that I got during my visits to the Caribbean as well. There's certainly, certainly in Jamaica, there's not always a lot of sympathy, basically, for the Windrush generation. But I also think that's because there's a lack of understanding of actually what the scandal entailed and right. the impact that it had. So one of the responses that I got was, you know, well, they've had decades to naturalise, they've had decades to get their house in order, and that this was something that people should have expected. And I was quite taken aback by those responses. But again, I thought they were quite a conservative contingent, basically, within the Caribbean that really sees this as
Can understand why people didn't want to talk about it, because there was this kind of very hostile external atmosphere. They were getting really, really unpleasant letters from the Home Office. They weren't telling their own children. And there was a sense that maybe, you know, this was their fault. And I found it incredibly helpful much later when Wendy Williams's report came out to find that she had identified some government information leaflets from the early 1980s, when there was a push telling people that they could come forward and naturalise or get ILR. And that paperwork made it really clear that actually, if you didn't want to do that, you didn't have to, and your rights would be completely unaffected. So that, for me, made it really very, very clear that actually there is no blame to be attributed to the people who were affected, because actually they made a decision, and a decision that was approved of by the Home Office at the time.
Did the issue of ID cards ever come up? Because the UK doesn't have a national ID card system, which then makes it very difficult in terms of this scandal, for example, for people to actually prove who they are, and that's given rise to certain debates over the need to implement an ID or the kind of justifications for it. I just wondered
discussion that I've had a few times, and I thought for a while, well, maybe things would have been much simpler if we'd had an ID card system. But I think if we had, you know, we still would have had to go through the process of getting people into that system, and it's very likely that the people who had difficulties proving their status this time could have faced similar difficulties in order to get the ID card. So I'm not sure that it completely answers that problem. But I am interested, and I keep wishing to find out what the situation in France is, and whether they've escaped similar difficulties because they have a much more stringent ID card system.
Well, I was actually recently in the Netherlands, and I was looking at the Dutch childcare benefits scandal. And that, I think, has got strong parallels with the Windrush case in terms of how it was basically a computer algorithm that started flagging up basically racialised groups and migrant groups to the Dutch benefits system and basically took away their welfare payments. So I think there are parallel cases that I think, certainly for the Windrush scandal itself, I think we could all learn from as well, to see where these patterns are emerging. And I think it says a lot about modern day governance systems, and also how people's identity and how their legal status are now being kind of inputted into computer databases. I know that's
really interesting. Yeah, I'd love to know more about it. But there is a kind of ID card system by default already in the UK for a lot of newer arrivals who have to get biometric passes, and who have to be fingerprinted and photographed, and are required to show ID in a way that.
But that just shows the divide, right, between who is citizen and who is migrant as well. And I thought it was fascinating when I interviewed Tony Smith, for example, formerly of the Home Office, because again, he said, for people working in the Home Office in the 1960s and the early 70s, it was very clear that if you were from the Commonwealth, therefore you went into the line with British citizens.
Yeah.
And I thought that was the lack of... I'm quite interested in hearing about your engagement with the Home Office, for example, because just that lack of institutional memory, and also the comments, as you said, like that Wendy Williams has made and her observations that that there is an absolute failure on behalf of the British state to actually understand Britain's colonial history and the impact of that. I just think it was, and that resonates with. You know, the people who were affected by this, who you've worked with very closely, because they didn't understand, right? The immigration officials had no concept of, you know, for example, the 1971 Immigrants Act. They had Immigration Act. They had no concept of, you know, really, really quite obvious and basic tenets of a kind of British immigration citizenship policy that they just
I mean, fair enough to not know the details of the legislation, but to not have an understanding about a whole kind of pattern of migration that really characterised the 20th century and that talked to our role as a colonial empire, that's, I think, the thing that I find really... amazing. Although here I am, somebody who studied history, has been kind of working, writing about Home Office issues, I had to educate myself a lot as I was trying to understand what might be going wrong. So I definitely feel very critical of people within the Home Office, and I'd feel very upbeat, I suppose, about one of the new initiatives that has been introduced in the wake of Windrush, which is a module that all civil servants working in visas and immigration will have to go through to educate them in the history of empire and Britain's past as a colonial power.
Although so, I think the uptake of that has been actually incredibly
it's
low.
It's been very
well.
Low.
So it sounds great in theory.
It's been low, but they've only just started to roll it out in the last couple of months. So there are two elements to it, but we'll see. Yeah.
So I'm interested in your engagement with the Home Office. Mm. Who did you speak to directly? What numbers did you even call to when you started investigating the story? Because the Home Office is notoriously impossible to get through and costly as well. For people who are within the system to actually even be able to speak to a human being on the other end. So I just wondered, did you have any insider contacts, or did you have any help or support basically in identifying individuals within the Home Office who were responsive to your question?
No, I'd say. So I went through the system that all journalists have to go through, which is a much quicker system in terms of being on hold than the system that people who are trying to regularise their immigration status go through. But nevertheless, it's not straightforward. But as a journalist, if you're ever writing about something that touches on or particularly criticises a government department, it's a convention that you'll go to that department, outline what you're planning to write, and give them an opportunity to comment.
And did they respond? Did they comment?
Yeah, they responded every time. Okay. And it was largely, to begin with, a kind of exercise in, I think, damage limitation. So they would give me a very standard comment for publication, but they would also tip off somebody within the system that we were going to be writing about a particular individual, and then time after time we'd notice that that individual's case would suddenly, after years of difficulty, be expedited, and quite often, even before the article was published, they would have they'd call me to say that they'd suddenly had a courier arriving at their door with some documents that they'd literally been waiting for years for. So the Home Office was very keen, it seemed to me, to try to manage this as an issue, by dealing one by one with all of the cases that we highlighted, so that they were able to say, you know, there's been an anomaly here, we're dealing with it, but this is not a widely experienced problem. But one of the things I found really disturbing about the response was that they would often blame the individual, say it's their fault for not having filled out the correct forms or not having paid actually a large amount of money to go through the process of applying for ILR, or they would say,
so ILR, indefinite leave to remain,
yeah, which they didn't need to apply for because they were in fact people who had citizenship already, or who were eligible for citizenship already. But the Home Office told people that that was the route that they needed to take.
And they had to take life in the UK test, which meant also proving that they had a level of English as well. Obviously for the Anglophone Caribbean is insulting.
But the Home Office, Press Office also said, and this was the moment at which I thought that, you know, they really have got no sense of what's going on here. They also said that individual needs to seek legal advice. And that was a particularly disturbing message to hear, because you weren't able to get legal advice for this area anymore because of reforms to legal aid. Mm-hmm. And also, most of the people who I was interviewing were people who had been told by the Home Office that they weren't allowed to work because they were immigration offenders. And so they were people often who weren't even able to apply for benefits. They were people who were living in the most kind of difficult financial circumstances. And so to be told that they needed to hire an immigration lawyer was just very, very out of touch.
And I remember you saying in your book as well about, I think it was in Jamaica, that somebody was blocked from returning to the UK, but then suddenly his passport appeared and he was sent a first class ticket as well to then return. So I think
after I called the Home Office, Press Office, and it was just I don't know, it's just very cynicism inducing that you as a department, rather than responding by stepping back and saying, isn't it peculiar that there are these cases coming forward and they all seem to be very similar and the problems appear to have come as a result of the legislation that we've passed in the last 4 or 5 years. Rather than taking a kind of macro approach to it, the response was to try to deal with each case individually and to downplay any excitement on our part.
But it's deeper than that, I think, because it also means that you're a white woman of certain privilege and social standing who's having to intervene in individual cases to actually resolve something that was their right in the first place. So I think it just shows just how deeply unjust, really, the system is, and just how cruel it's been to individuals.
Absolutely. I mean, it was very stark to see people who had been, people like Paulette Wilson, who went for 2 years to the Home Office Reporting Centre in Solihull, and she had to go there. It cost her a lot of money to go there. It was very, very difficult for her to go there. Every time she went there, she said, you know, this is a mistake, you've made a mistake. And for 2 years, she said that so many times, they got so annoyed with her and with her daughter that they even stopped her daughter from going into the building with her anymore, because she'd been saying so consistently and vociferously that they had made a mistake. Certainly the speed with which media attention got that decision overturned is very stark.
So as part of this project, we recently went to see the wonderful Lenny Henry one-man play at the Bush Theatre in London, and I understand that I was just really impacted by the play. I just thought it was just absolutely wonderful, and I know that you played a role, was it a consulting role in kind of advising on that play, and of the many things that kind of just really I don't know struck me about it, it was just so deeply moving. But there's a part in it where he is sat on his sofa and a letter falls from the ceiling, And that letter is from, it's not from the Home Office, it's from
Capita,
which is a third party, a private company that's been hired by the Home Office to send out these letters to people. And as the play continues, then more and more of these letters start kind of cascading from the ceiling, and it's very, yeah, it's just a very impactful kind of image of bureaucracy, basically, and the violence of bureaucracy and how overwhelming it can be, and just how terribly he was treated, August England, the main character, how he was treated within this. So, yeah, I wanted to thank you for that, because I just absolutely just took so much away from that experience.
It's an amazing play. Yeah,
amazing.
I really hope that it gets a transfer or that more people can see it.
Yeah, for me it was career defining for Lenny Henry. I just thought, and obviously being from the West Midlands as well, it was there were a lot of in jokes there that I really appreciated. But tell me about Capita. That really struck me, because how the immigration system is managed, and then who are the people who are actually doing, you know, it's a bit like the shoot the messenger scenario, right? You're taking out the Home Office are removing itself from that responsibility and then passing it on to private companies that are basically making a lot of money, because the immigration system is, you know, very lucrative for certain players who are involved in that.
I don't know how much in the end Capita made from this contract, because it was a payment by results contract, and I'm afraid I don't have the figures at the tip of my fingers anymore, but they were given a list of suspected immigration offenders by the Home Office, and they were going to be paid for the number of people on that list who they could get to leave the country voluntarily after a series of contacts by phone, by letter, and particularly controversially by text. I think in the end, the information that the Home Office gave them was so flawed and inaccurate that they didn't actually manage to make a very significant number of people on that list leave the country. So I don't know whether the payment model worked in their favour in this case. But it's you're right that it's the case that a lot of the harder bits of Home Office work have been subcontracted out to private companies, and often subcontracted to other companies by those first layer of organisations. And it does make it very hard as a journalist, and also I expect for MPs and organisations who are looking into this to work out exactly where responsibility lies. It's very hard to ask questions by FOI or even through the press office about contracts to private companies, because they're often given a blanket response that they won't be responded to for commercial reasons. So it's really problematic.
But and it also highlights the brutality of this target-driven culture, right? To say that either Home Office officials or private companies have to achieve a certain amount of, certain number of detainees or deportees is really quite horrifying, I think, to think about. That is what is driving the kind of culture behind.
Yeah, and that's the issue that caused Amber Rudd, who was then Home Secretary, to have to leave, because she attempted to deny that there were any targets on the removal of people from the UK, and it turned out that there were very clear targets, by which point she was in an impossible position, because either she looked like she'd lied to Parliament, or she hadn't really got a grasp of what her own department was doing. So she resigned.
So, I mean, there are many British MPs that were already either involved or aware of kind of individual cases around the scandal. Kate Osmore, for example, that springs to mind. And then also many people who came out and were just absolute damning of the UK government, including obviously Diana Abbott and then David Lammy and many, countless others. But also you talk quite a lot about the role of the Barbados High Commissioner Guy Hewitt, and also the role of the Caribbean High Commissioners around the time of the CHOGM meeting of 2018, which is really, I think they met a week before CHOGM, and that's when the real anger around the issue kind of really culminated. I just wondered what you can say about kind of maybe some of the individuals basically who were key to either flagging this issue either to the Home Office or people within the UK government, including Theresa May, and kind of the diplomatic discussions that were going on around that time, because that's really when it all really
yeah. So when I was sitting at my desk trying to work out how to continue to highlight this was a really problematic issue. One of the things that I tried to do quite early on was to talk to the High Commissioners in London, and that's more difficult than it sounds. There was no immediate enthusiasm to confront this issue, particularly with the Jamaican High Commissioner. I did go and see him after some time, and it wasn't an issue.
Was that Ramakan?
Who is a very friendly and nice man, but it's true to say it wasn't something that he was very engaged with. And he told me a story when I went to see him about having visited himself 6 months earlier a detention centre in the UK, and he'd met somebody there who told him that he was originally from Jamaica but had spent a lifetime in the UK. And he told me that as an anecdote that was kind of, you know, that he thought in the moment was quite an interesting anecdote. But I was really upset by it because I said, what did you do next? What happened to them? Were they taken off the list? And he didn't really know. So it was a slightly unhelpful exchange at that point. Later, Guy Hewitt, who was then Barbados High Commissioner to the UK, did agree to talk to me, and he was actually very quickly interested in what this issue was about, and took it on in a very engaged and kind of activist style, very unlike most other diplomats. He was really ready to talk about it, to gather other diplomats and kind of race relations activists together to try and push it further up the political agenda. But I'm not sure that even he really wanted to go on, you know, television to talk about it. He was trying to do something a bit more behind the scenes and tried to get a meeting with Theresa May during this Commonwealth Heads of Government Summit.
In
April of 2018, and that request was turned down by Theresa May's office.
So she never met with the High Commissioner?
She did in the end, because the request was turned down, and Guy Hewitt talked about it being turned down, and he wasn't cross about it, but I remember thinking that's really strange.
Yeah.
And so I telephoned him, and he, in a sort of very diplomatic way, expressed disappointment about it. And so I wrote a piece that went in the on the Guardian's front page, and that was a very, very interesting to me moment, because that was the moment at which all of the other media in the UK, which hadn't really been that interested in this as an issue, agreed to also report on it after we had a front page piece saying that Theresa May had refused to have a meeting with these High Commissioners.
So I know from the oral history interviews that were really conducted that the Caribbean Caucus, for example, of High Commissioners, they met regularly and they would invite the Home Office, for example, to their meetings to talk about this. So there were conversations happening where this issue was being flagged. I know it was flagged to Philip Hammond as well, wasn't it? At the UK Caribbean Forum in the Bahamas, but also
a couple of years earlier.
Yeah, a couple of years earlier, but also really the project is highlighting that this is a decades-long problem, right? This is something that has been going on. It's certainly not something that began when you started investigating it, but it's something that has been part of the history, basically, of people from the Caribbean who have come to the UK for a very long time. So how that's I'm fascinated by how the scandal erupted in 2018, and obviously the Chogham, it was kind of, you know, a Guy Hewitt is very much credited with his kind of guerrilla activism or diplomacy, as he terms it, and also your work, evidently, and Patrick Vernon, and all of these things kind of came together. Why then? Why do you think that all kind of came to, erupted at that time?
No, it is.
And why didn't it happen before? And I asked this because I was recently at the George Padmore Institute looking through the Caribbean Times, which was a paper that was launched in the early 1980s. So obviously a lot of those articles were talking about the time of the changes to...
Amazing.
I'll send you the
pictures. To hear.
But changes to, obviously, the British Nationality Act. And so we know that for decades community actions were happening, campaigns were happening, meetings were happening, raids, passport raids as well, were taking place. It's just quite interesting that there's been this abysmal treatment, basically, of black people in Britain, as we've known. It's not something that's new, but why did the scandal kind of resonate so much and hit the headlines?
I think that there are two different things that were going on. There was a problem with travel from the UK back to the Caribbean, and people getting stuck in the Caribbean and not able to return was something that had been happening for decades and which was unresolved and which didn't particularly make newspaper headlines. And I can't explain why high commissioners were not more willing, why British high commissioners in the Caribbean at that stage were not more willing to be helpful. I find that very disturbing.
Although the Gleaner did, I suppose that was the mainstream. That's when people in Jamaica really started hearing more about the Windrush scandal as well, was the case of the gentleman whose name escapes me right now, but who couldn't return to... Mm-hmm. To the UK, so there were like,
but there were, but there were, lo- there were so many of these cases
right
back to the 1980s of people who got stuck in the wrong place and who became destitute, who had really, really horrific experiences. So there was that was happening. Then the situation in the UK really, really intensified as a result of the hostile environment legislation in the 2010s. And then, so those two things were happening. And it's a kind of a side point, but the Conservative government and successive Home Office ministers, whenever they apologise for this scandal, they have a formulation of apologising for it, which I find very vexing, where they say that this was an issue that had not been picked up by successive governments as a way of kind of spreading the blame between themselves and by previous Labour governments. And there's an element of truth in that, but I think it is really disingenuous because internally within the UK, the vast majority of people who were affected by the scandal were affected as a direct result of this hostile environment legislation that made life impossible for people. Regard nothing to do with travelling around the world, going back to the Caribbean, but made life impossible for people internally with employment, housing, NHS treatment, benefits, driving licence, mobile phone contracts, the works. And so to try to kind of shift the blame equally between this administration and previous administrations is disingenuous. But nevertheless, it's true that this was something that was causing problems for people for decades earlier. And the question of why it only hit the headlines in April 2018 is kind of a mystifying one.
What about Brexit as well? Because of the conversations, the debates around Brexit that were happening. Do you think that was... I mean, it's come up a lot in this project, and a lot more than I'd initially anticipated.
In terms of creating a more hostile environment around immigration internally?
Yeah, negativity and a hostility towards othering, basically, people. But also, the lack of uncertainty for EU citizens, again, in terms of people who have been here for many years who haven't registered and may find it difficult to actually prove their residency.
Mm.
So I just wondered how prominent that was in terms of...
I mean, It wasn't something that people who were affected were talking about particularly, because it was something else going on. But it certainly created that general environment whereby stories about immigration were not positive stories, and that I think contributed to it being a hidden problem for such a long time, because the people who were affected were not people who wanted particularly to talk about it to anyone, even within their own households. So they weren't people who were, on the whole, making an enormous amount of noise about it. And then the few people who did want to make a noise about it, who went to see their MP, who tried to go to their law centres, found it really, really hard to get any attention to be paid to it.
Okay. So as part of kind of your investigative journalism, you travelled to the Caribbean, I believe. Was it just Jamaica that you went to?
Yeah, it's the only part of the Caribbean I've ever been to.
Tell me about when that was, and kind of what the motivation was for going there, and what that experience was.
So it was a few weeks after the government apologised and promised to put things right. But by that point, it was clear that there were a large number of people who'd been entirely wrongly deported. And I was keen to try to find some of those people who'd been wrongly deported. And I have to say that I still haven't really succeeded in that. And that's a bit of reporting that, I'd like to try and do again. Because we don't know exactly how many people were wrongly removed or deported. We know that 180 or 190 people were either detained or deported, and the Home Office, for whatever reason, won't break that down into the number of people who were wrongly removed. Mm-hmm. And in any case, we think that that's likely to be a huge underestimate of the figures, because it's only figures are only being counted to people wrongly removed in the Caribbean, and the Home Office say it would be too expensive to widen the search to look at people who've been wrongly removed to other countries. Although I didn't find on that trip people who had been wrongly deported, I did find a lot of people who'd been unable to travel back to the UK. I hadn't been to Jamaica before. It was a very sad trip. I love to go to Jamaica at some point on holiday, but I definitely didn't see that side of the country.
You were in Kingston.
I went to Kingston, and then we drove with a photographer from The Guardian, David Levine, and a really helpful local driver. We drove all the way to the west coast, to Savannah-le-Mer, where we met somebody called Vernon Van Riel, who's a former professional boxer who grew up mostly in Tottenham, and I think had arrived in Tottenham from Jamaica at around the age of 8, had been to primary school and secondary school, had a very successful boxing career, and set up his own business as an electrician, but had got stuck in Jamaica in the early 2000s when he'd travelled out there and stayed longer for 2 years, and hadn't realised that the immigration legislation in the UK had changed. And by the time we met him, he was living in an abandoned roadside shack with no electricity, no running water, and he really didn't have any money to speak of, and he was very unwell. So it was one of the most disturbing bits of reporting I've ever had to do. But again, I phoned the Home Office to say that I was talking to Vernon van Riel. I gave them his date of birth, his... I don't know if he had a Home Office reference number, but they were able quite quickly to identify his case. And by that point, he had himself applied to return under the new Windrush scheme. But the phone call that... that I had with the Home Office press office really expedited things, I assume, because 2 days later he had a first class ticket on British Airways couriered to him from Kingston, you know, at vast expense. He rang me and he said that the price on the ticket was something like £1,400. I mean, it was amazing and also insane. Mm.
Did you have any contact with the High Commission when you were in Jamaica?
And yeah.
Were there any observations or anything of interest, maybe?
So I did have a conversation with the High Commissioner. From memory, it was an off-the-record conversation. So he was pretty anxious about being...
That was with Asif Ahmad.
With Asif Ahmad, yeah. He was quite anxious about being quoted on the record. So it was frustrating from a journalistic perspective because on the one hand, he was there giving access and giving some background information, but he wasn't ready to go on the record to say anything. And I do... think it's a really remarkable failure by the Foreign Office in Jamaica and I assume elsewhere that they were so unwilling to engage with the large numbers of people who got stuck in Jamaica and so unwilling to assist them as you would expect to be assisted as a UK citizen in having a difficult time abroad.
But I mean, even as early as the 1960s, there's evidence that, you know, the High Commissions were being used as strategic outposts, basically, to ensure that people didn't even leave Jamaica, for example. So I think it's quite fascinating if we think of it on those terms about how the role of what British High Commissions are. And actually their level of engagement with people who have a legal and existing right to either enter and settle in the UK. And a lot of that is not clear, basically, to people who are in the Caribbean. It's not clear what their rights are, what they can apply for, how they can travel to see family. And I think we've created that, the UK certainly has created that system, you know, that kind of closed door policy. Basically, we see it with the Home Office, we see it with kind of how people engage with trying to get their paperwork or their visas or whatever.
But in terms of kind of really stark examples of racism within all of this, I just think it's the clearest example that you have people who are British, I don't even quite know what to say in terms of the word, but people who believe that they are British citizens seeking help in the way that British citizens seek help when they're abroad and in trouble and finding that they are unable to even get a hearing of any sort.
Even get through the door, right? Because everything is now... it's on a computer database, people are told to actually go away and apply online, so people don't even have that kind of human interaction anymore with any kind of government official that can help them. Right, so we're about to wrap up the interview now. Thank you so much for your time. Is there anything else that you'd like to say?
There was one thing that we began to talk about and I kind of got distracted, but it's about the scale of the problem and whether or not we really know how many people have been affected and why it is that we don't really have an idea. And I really, really struggle with this. So I think we know that 15,000 people, more or less, have applied for documentation under the Windrush scheme, although that even that isn't as simple a number as it might be in terms of a guide to how many people have been affected, because there are some EU citizens who have applied under that scheme as well. We know that around 4,000 people have applied for compensation. I think it is, but again, that feels like a huge underestimate for the wider number of people affected, because we know that many people are just not coming forward to claim compensation because the process is so difficult and because people are aware that it's not always a kind of that the payouts are not always very generous.
But it's also exposing individuals, isn't it?
It's a very, very painful experience to have to go through again, trying to document exactly how you were affected, and the difficulty of finding the documentary evidence to prove it is such a precise echo of the difficulties that people had previously in terms of trying to prove that they were British. So, and then there is the figure that you mentioned from the Oxford Migration
Observatory
of a possible upper limit of 57,000. Yeah, so we don't know, and I hope at some point that, you know, those figures will become clearer. I don't know if there's somewhere within the Home Office where there's that base of knowledge that, you know, will emerge at some point later on.
Where do you see the future heading then in terms of this issue?
I'm really worried by the current Home Secretary's determination, I think, to say this is an issue which we've apologised for and that we've dealt with and that we are now drawing a line under.
And her decision to withdraw three of the recommendations, I think, from the Wendy Williams report.
Three of the recommendations have been formally withdrawn, but I think that there's a kind of a wider winding down of the team responsible. So I think it's really important that we kind of continue to highlight that there was this issue. And I think the one bit of reporting I'd really like to do, and I don't know if it's possible, but would somehow to be able to get all of the accounts of the people who've applied to compensation somehow in a redacted form into the public domain, because as a way of showing exactly how badly people were affected and how many people were really badly affected, I think there's kind of no more potent database for that. So even if it's something that somebody has to do in a generation's time when those files come
to light,
are allowed to be accessed, it would be a really, really worthwhile exercise.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your time today.